a shambles of a presidential debate, tensions in Hoosier schools, plus Mitch Daniels and local COVID restrictions, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 2nd, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Americans got to see what some have called the worst presidential debate in the country's history, a spectacle of falsehoods, attacks, and at times, incomprehensibility. President Donald Trump's strategy was clear from the outset. He repeatedly interrupted and talked over his opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden.
I want to make sure...
You graduated last in your class, not first in your class.
I want to make
Mr.
sure...
Mr. President, can you let him finish, sir?
No, he doesn't know how to do that.
Despite protests from moderator Chris Wallace, that continued. Biden struggled to talk past Trump until he couldn't ignore him anymore.
Radical question. Left.
Will you who shut
is
up,
your,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on your
so
list?
Right.
Gentlemen,
this
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
But perhaps the most talked about moment of the debate came when Wallace asked if Trump would condemn white supremacy and militia groups who have contributed to violence at protests this year. Trump said he's willing to do that before pressed by Wallace and Biden.
Well, then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a left-wing.
The next day, Trump said he doesn't know who the Proud Boys are and said they should stand down and let law enforcement do its work. Did this help anyone? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, did this debate have any impact on this race?
Well, you know, I think it clarified for anybody who thought what you see wasn't what you got. I mean, Trump's performance was terrible. I mean, it was disgraceful, narcissistic. I mean, he gave comfort to white supremacists, which is the way he believes, obviously. And it was just, it was indecent the way he performed. So anybody who harbored any thoughts that this person was fit to be in the Oval Office couldn't believe that. Now, among his supporters, they're going to say, oh, you know, he was tough. Well, he wasn't just tough. He was absolutely indecent, I think is the only word I'd use for him. He had no command of the language, no command of the facts, no command of truth. I mean, he didn't even have a loose association with truth. And then he tried to bring the drug problem of former Vice President Biden's son into it, as if there isn't a history in the Trump family of all kinds of problems. But anyway, it was embarrassing, and I think it hurt our reputation around the world. It not just in this country, but around the world. And he ought to be ashamed of himself.
Obviously, a lot of attention on President Trump's performance, but did it really end up helping or hurting enough either candidate to make a difference?
I don't think. Well, look. First of all, I think these debates are shows, and there's no better showman than Donald Trump. I mean, so he was going for, and that was how he approached it. Clearly, this was not a debate of substance for him. It was a debate of style and just trying to dominate the stage. But he, you know, keep in mind, in 2016, he lost three debates. I mean, it wasn't close. I mean, he lost to Hillary Clinton in all of those debates, and he won the election. So I'll take losing the debates over winning the election, I guess, any day of the week.
But let me ask this. Donald Trump is behind in the polls way more this time than he was 4 years ago, and it's really not all that close across the country. So did he need to do a better job in this debate necessarily than Joe Biden did?
Well, I wouldn't put everything in the poll numbers, because I put everything in the poll numbers 4 years ago and look where that got me. So, and you know, in terms of this situation, there were, believe it or not, there are probably some undecided voters at this point. I mean, it's hard to believe that at this point, when you've had this much of a tug of war back and forth, and there's such a disparity in the candidates themselves, that there would still be somebody scratching his or her head saying, I'm just not sure. And if, in fact, part of the goal here was to go after those individuals and maybe assure, for instance, female suburban voters, if you're Donald Trump, that, hey, I'm a nice guy. Maybe I say some wacky things once in a while, but I'm the kind of candidate that you can go with. I don't think he accomplished that. I think, if anything, he alienated those individuals. He may have, you know, thrown a little red meat to his own base, but they were with him anyway. So I would say clearly it was a net loss for the president on any number of levels. But certainly, if in fact his goal was to pick off some of those undecideds, which, Brandon, you point out is necessary to overcome that gap, well, then I'd say two thumbs down.
And Nikki, you've covered a lot of debates. You've seen a lot of moderators. There was some attention on the job that Chris Wallace did, with a lot of people on both sides saying, giving him a negative performance evaluation. But what was he supposed to do?
Yeah, I don't think you could pay me to take that job. I will say the only criticism I have for him, because he tried repeatedly to get things back on track, the only criticism I have is that he had very kind of compound questions. And so the question, like, I think if he would just been a little more straightforward with the questions, because Donald Trump was already trying to nitpick the question.
And honestly, both candidates did that a little bit. They tried to start answering the question before Chris was done asking.
Yeah, I just would have been maybe a little bit more direct on the questions without sort of building all the background into the question. But that's it. Otherwise, I think he did absolutely the best job he could in an untenable situation.
Although, as I agree with that criticism, I do the same thing with my questions way too often. So before we talk about the next topic, I want to talk about something that we just found out, well, for some in the middle of the night, for a lot of us when we woke up this morning, which is that Donald Trump, President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump have tested positive for COVID-19. They tested positive, I think, yesterday is what the reports have it now. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife have both tested negative, but we are seeing a lot of folks. It started with Hope Hicks, which is a key Trump aide, tested positive. We learned that yesterday. We now know that Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who was at the Saturday event with the Supreme Court nominee, he's tested positive. Father John Jenkins, president of Notre Dame, also at that Saturday event, has tested positive. So I'll start with you on this one, then, Mike. President Trump testing positive. So far, they say he has mild symptoms and he's otherwise doing well. What impact does that have 30-something days out from the election?
I guess we'll see. I think it's got to change the rallies he's putting on. It doesn't help anybody down ballot that Eric Holcomb is not doing massive campaign rallies, and Donald Trump is. And I think part of the frustration that we all have is the inconsistent nature of these restrictions. And when you've got, and it just fuels people thinking this is nonsense. And so when you've got Trump doing million-person rallies and all these other politicians really trying to practice social distancing and not having big events, and if you have a dinner, you're in a big room with a small number of people.
And everybody wearing masks.
It makes it harder to message for everybody else that's on the ballot this year. And so he's got to like stop doing these rallies, because now they're clearly spreading the disease.
What impact does Donald Trump testing positive have on the race?
Well, there's a certain irony in this, because he tried to ridicule Joe Biden for wearing a mask while he was in the middle of the debate, and there he is. And he knew, by the way, he knew on Wednesday that Hope Hicks had tested positive, and he still did a mass rally fundraiser on Thursday. So these people who contributed their money may get an additional bonus. They may come out being positive for COVID, and the fact that the other people around him have tested negative right now doesn't mean anything. The virus has to build up in your system for several days before you get a positive reading. So we don't know when he was infectious. We don't know that. We don't know that it was Hope Hicks. We don't know that it didn't occur before that, or that she wasn't positive before that. And so it could affect a wide variety of people, all because of his irresponsible conduct in making mask wearing an ideological issue. And that's the biggest mistake and the biggest failing of his entire presidency, is to put 207,000 lives at risk and 7 million people with the disease, all because he couldn't do what was right.
Do you think, Nikki, do you think this changes perhaps the perception of those who follow Donald Trump and don't take COVID seriously? Is the fact that the president got it maybe changing some minds out there of folks who, like Mike pointed out, don't think this is a big deal?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think probably what will happen is Trump will have mild symptoms and he'll say, see, it's no big deal, you know. But the fact that he actually did get it while going out and about without a mask, and he kept saying, well, you know, I'm tested every day. The people around me are tested out every day. But not when he's going into another state and you know, meeting all these people. And obviously those rapid tests are not 100% fail-proof. Right. In fact, the more rapid they are, the less accurate they are. Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice-Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will the first presidential debate end up having an impact on which candidate wins the race? Yes, it will help Joe Biden. Yes, it will help Donald Trump. Or no, it won't have an impact. Last week, we asked you if you think President Trump's Supreme Court nominee will be confirmed by the Senate before the November 3rd election. 55% of you say yes, 45% say no, which is honestly a lot closer than I thought it was going to be. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, school leaders across Indiana are considering a full-time return to school buildings for most students very soon. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains that many teachers feel overwhelmed and say they need more support.
Most schools in Indiana started the new academic year with some sort of in-person instruction, but teachers say the so-called hybrid learning models are burning them out and fast. Crawfordsville High School teacher Emily Race says her school is bringing most students back for in-person learning next week, but with some kids still learning online from home because of quarantine or safety concerns, she's not feeling any relief.
So the only real change is that I have to create new seating charts to try to space out twice as many students in the same physical space.
Race says many teachers are working into the evening and over the weekends just to keep up. Many school leaders across Indiana are considering bringing a majority of students back to campus over the next few weeks.
Mike O'Brien, are the state and its school districts doing enough to support teachers in this very weird year?
Yeah, clearly not. I mean, I don't, the problem is, I mean, imagine anybody who's not a teacher, imagine having to do your job twice. You've got to do it. You got to go to the meeting, and then you've got to go to the next room and do a virtual meeting or prepare or call everybody who was supposed to be on the conference call and have the same meeting. That's what they're dealing with. They're dealing with parents who want to voluntarily keep their kids at home, but they want virtual education to support them. Other parents want their kids to be in the classroom. You've got this. You've got a broad diversity of schools' capabilities and connectivity around the state that make it impossible in some places to do virtual. I mean, this is part of the reason Senate Republicans months ago now, or 2 months ago, when we dealt with the funding issue, were trying to use the one hammer they had on funding to force schools' hands to put them back, put kids back in schools. Now, there were a lot of motivations for that. One of them going, so if the legislature is going to look at this, my guess is they're going to look at less virtual and more in-person and not more resources into the classroom. But clearly, these teachers need relief. You've doubled their job in most cases.
How, when we're talking about do teachers need support, I'm assuming you say yes too, but so as part of that though, it's not like, you know, Indiana's budget is overflowing right now like anybody else's, so how are we delivering that support?
Well, we're sitting on over $1 billion in aid that was supposed to help in these cases, okay? That's what we're sitting on because Eric Holcomb wants to plug the budget because he doesn't want to have to raise taxes because that would just be terrible under those circumstances. The only thing he thinks are important are lowering taxes and keeping a surplus. Teacher pay, not so much. You know, he was in the military, and he should understand the notion of combat pay. Anybody who thinks that these teachers aren't in combat is not paying attention. This is really, teaching by itself is a tough job. This job is double or triple the work, and we ought to be giving them at least the kinds of support they need to make sure those classrooms are safe, and that they have the equipment they need to work virtually, and that they have a bump in pay to understand or to appreciate the work they're doing, and we're not doing any of those.
This problem kind of exists even under the best case scenario, though, too, right? Because even if you are a school district who the COVID situation in your community is doing well, you bring all of the kids back in school and are treating things relatively like normal while following those guidelines that you're supposed to follow around COVID, but kid gets it, the whole class is out, or at least a dozen kids are out, or them and all their siblings are out. And so you have kids doing virtual learning at the same time they're doing in-person learning in the classroom. So this problem exists even in those school districts that Senate Democrats have wanted everybody to return to in-person, right?
Yeah, I mean, the quarantining process is, you know, you see one person gets it, and the next thing you know, 40 kids are out. So that's going to happen regardless. And obviously, increase in pay would help. But, you know, also maybe we should spend some of that money on hiring some support staff, you know.
Good idea.
Maybe they can grade all the papers, you know. Right. Maybe they can't actually stand in front of the kids giving the instruction because they don't have the proper certification. But, you know,
Right,
exactly. So there are some things that could probably be helping teachers.
John Schwanis, educators, we heard about educators up in Fort Wayne proposing a couple of different things to help this, which is one, either late starts, two-hour late starts, but that gets into a whole other problem of kids making sure or parents getting their kids off to school. But a day where you don't have students, so a day, basically a teacher work day where they can catch up on all this stuff without having to also be teaching their students. Do either one of those seem feasible?
The second of the two probably seems more doable because the first one, it may aid some of the teachers, but think of the wrench that's being thrown into on the home front as parents are scrambling already to try to deal with their own telecommuting and their own workplace issues and the notion of trying to get, you know, is it a full moon, odd number day of the week, do I take the kid to school today or what? I mean, it's asking a lot, I think.
I suppose the same problem exists if you're taking a day off, which is now you have to
now
find child care for the entire day.
Well, so. My assumption was that they would be
somewhere else.
I mean, and if that's not the case, well, then that's problematic. I would just say this. It's a mess no matter how you slice it, and I think we all need to recognize that this is largely going to be a lost year. And I say that it's not the fault of teachers.
Or students or anybody else.
Maybe even students, although I'll put more burden on students probably simply because, it's nobody's fault. But the teachers are working hard. I'm sure a lot of students are working hard, but I don't think there's any substitute, especially in those primary grades when you're learning your basic math skills and your basic writing skills and those types of things. There's no replacement for that classroom setting. And I think the test scores, which obviously are still months away, are going to bear that out. The only comfort is they're all
count.
In this together,
yeah.
So nobody's getting an advantage.
All right. Well, Purdue University President Mitch Daniels, along with Greater Lafayette and university healthcare leaders, signed an open letter to Tippecanoe County's health officer this week, urging him to allow the health department's bar and restaurant order to remain in place for another month. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg reports the letter comes after local officials have voiced support for removing some restrictions.
Tippecanoe County Health Officer Dr. Jeremy Adler's guidelines include capping capacity at 75% and closing establishments at midnight. The county order is more strict than Stage 5 of Indiana's reopening plan, which allows restaurants to open at full capacity with social distancing. Tuesday's letter, published in the Lafayette Journal and Courier, addresses the push for Adler to roll back some of the rules outlined in the order. Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski has voiced his support for a later closing time, and he and Tippecanoe County Commissioner Tracy Brown have both addressed the financial impact the order has had on local businesses. But the letter points to the broader economic impact on the community if relaxed guidelines at bars and restaurants lead to a spike in COVID-19 cases that could send Purdue students home.
Nikki Kelly, is this a fight we will see more of now that Indiana has lifted almost all of its COVID restrictions and left things much more up to these local leaders?
I think so. Obviously, with Governor Holcomb, you know, opening the doors pretty much as he can, it puts all the burden on local entities to respond to outbreaks and try to kind of roll them back in before they spread. So definitely we'll see more of that in the larger urban areas.
Governor Holcomb has empowered local leaders to make stricter restrictions throughout this entire, since the stay-at-home order was lifted, he has said the entire time locals can do whatever they want as long as it's more and not less restrictive. So in that case here, where we do see these larger urban areas kind of putting the clamps or keeping the clamps down, is that the best approach from a state level?
It's probably the only approach. I'm not sure what other options there are. If the governor and the statewide administration has said we are not going to impose any further the kind of mask mandate that we had in place before, who else is going to enforce it? It's either, you know, something at that level or nothing. And it's not surprising that you'd see this in, you know, Lafayette, West Lafayette, and other areas. I mean, it's college
yeah.
towns. If you look at not just Indiana, look all over the country. College towns are some of the hardest hit areas. That, and I don't think we all need to, you know, be rocket scientists or even epidemiologists to figure out why that might be the case. So Not surprising that some of those areas are going to have to be a little bit more careful a little bit longer.
Some of Indiana's COVID metrics are starting to trend the wrong direction. They have for several days now. Hospitalizations, the positivity rate, things like that. And Governor Holcomb was asked this week about, and we haven't even seen the impact of what theoretically opening up to stage five has done. We won't see that for at least another week or two. Governor Holcomb was asked this week whether he has any second thoughts about going to stage five, and he said no. We're, you know, hunkered down where the spread is occurring locally, and that's how we'll manage our way through this. Does that risk coming off as tone deaf?
I don't think so. I think, remember Plan A 6 months ago. Plan A was to put the entire state on lockdown, stay-at-home order, maintain in order to manage hospital capacity and the initial spread of the outbreak. There are now protocols in place, contact tracing protocols in place. We have a mask mandate that continues to be in place. So looking at this, where outbreaks are occurring locally and using those strategies we developed months ago is the right approach. If there's some catastrophic increase if what happens in the fall, we get this fall surge that's being anticipated, the governor's been very consistent all the way along that, look, we are looking at that data and we will make decisions based on it.
Is the state right now in a place where local decisions should lead and not right now a top-down approach?
Look, you have to have local decisions lead because he won't. Governor won't lead, okay? He's afraid of the right wing of his party and he's afraid of Donald Trump. We are fourth highest in growth of COVID cases of all the states per capita.
Or spread of COVID cases.
Of COVID, however you want to categorize it, which was one of the indicia that he looked to early when that number was down. It's now back up, and he won't admit it because he's afraid of the right wing of his party and he's afraid of Donald Trump. You have to have it down from the top down, and you have to not just have a mandate, but you have to say you've got to wear it or else. Because this isn't going away. It's not in the rearview mirror. It wasn't over by Easter. It wasn't over by 4th of July. It's not going to be over by Election Day. And he needs to step up and show leadership. And he's totally incapable of doing it. So I'm glad that the locals like Mitch Daniels and Joe Hogsett and the others are stepping forward, because otherwise there's a vacuum.
Well, less than half of the number of 18 and 19-year-olds are registered to vote in Indiana this year compared to what they were in 2016. And that decline is the worst in the nation.
Voter registration among those newly eligible Hoosier voters is 54% less this year than the last presidential election cycle, according to a new analysis from Tufts University. League of Women Voters of Indiana co-president Linda Hansen says COVID-19 has presented challenges that help explain that decline.
We have normally sent league members into schools to register people, and clearly we're not going into the schools right now.
Voting advocacy group Indiana Citizens' Bill Morrow says his organization is changing its focus ahead of the election because of those low numbers.
We are going to shift 100% of our social media spend to 18 and 19-year-olds.
Morrow says getting young people into the habit of voting helps them better become lifelong voters.
John Schwanis, I know we don't have that much time left on the show, and so this is a rather big question, but why can't we seem to get young people to vote?
I wish I knew. You know, it's a disaster. It's a tragedy. Folks like Bill Morrow and his organization, they're trying hard. But I don't know what it is. My kids all wanted to. That right up there with getting their driver's licenses, that was what they wanted to do, was vote. And maybe, I don't know, blame parents. I mean, it's a big deal. It's something you should want to do. So I don't know the answer. It's sad.
Linda Hansen talked about they can't go into schools right now, which does make sense. But I assume that's the case in a lot of states across the country. And we're still worst, according to that Tufts study. What is it about Indiana, then?
Yeah, I don't know what's specific to Indiana. I just know, speaking to my daughter in this, you know, younger age range, is her main issue and her friend's main issue is they don't see anyone that they can relate to. It's all a bunch of older white people, and they want a little more diversity in their
politicians. Is that a problem with, at least at the national level, certainly, where we do not have a young enough people in office?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, but I also think that the Republicans in the state of Indiana have taken voter suppression to an art form. I mean, none of these things are done unintentionally, and we discourage people from voting. We've had no big push to get people registered to vote. They have determined that the best way to keep the vote count down is to discourage anybody from ever getting into the cycle,
Mike,
and that's deliberate.
Mike, Linda Hansen talked about Indiana not having a culture of voting. Do you think that's true, though?
I think the youth question is engaging them in high school, engage them when they're young, make sure they're registered when they turn 18 and senior year in high school, and adopt in policies like that. You've got to engage them early. But Nikki is right. We've got to stop pretending like having people in their mid to late 70s running for the top two offices, or the top office in the country, isn't having an impact on young people.
Well, that's on a very light note, apparently. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.